Welcome back to The Tech Entrepreneur.
We will be discussing real challenges, real stories with real people.
We're here with Kyle from eBar. Welcome, Kyle.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Kyle, tell us who you are, what your title is at eBar, and give us the eBar pitch.
Yeah, so I'm Kyle. I'm the lead engineer at eBar Initiatives. So I've been with the company for about, I think it's coming up to 7 years now, I believe. But eBar existed about 2 years before I joined. It came about as actually a university project by two co-founders, Sam Pettifer and Nick Beeson. So Sam went to a rugby game in Murrayfield, actually, and he was waiting in a queue for the bar at halftime for ages and ages, as you normally do at any events game. And he missed Scotland's first try of the game. That sparked the idea for him to come up with that there must be a better way to solve this problem. And it was actually the university project that they had. They were just given a problem to solve. So they could do anything with that. It was a part of an MBA degree that they were doing at the time. Sam was annoyed that he couldn't get his drink on time. He was in this queue for ages, and that's how the project got started about eBar. Sam and Nick together then went down to EG Technology in Cambridge, a product design company, to play a round of beer, essentially.
Wow, tough times.
Yes, very difficult, especially, it's as good as university projects go. So they were getting cans of the cheapest Sainsbury's beer that you could get, like the unbranded ones, that just to see how quickly they could pour it. So they poured it in loads of different fun and magical different ways, like pouring it on the side, tilting the glass, just pouring it straight in, see what they could do, putting the can all the way down to the bottom of the cup and pulling up, just to try and find a quick way to pour. And they found out that the quickest way to pour this drink was under pressure. So the exact same way that breweries transfer their big tanks of beer into vessels and into kegs is they put pressure in it first and then they transfer the liquid. And by doing that, you prevent any CO2 breakout of the product as you transfer it. So they find by putting the pressure into the cup, they can pour beer a lot faster and release the pressure and then form the head. So it pours almost as if the product looks flat. But once they release the pressure, the head starts to form. So that's where the idea for eBar came from.
Wow.
Then with EG Technology, they developed the first alpha prototype, which proved the concept very well, as a prototype should do, brought to a few events just to demo it. But it was, although from the customer side it was easy, this gives a great looking pint. It was quite difficult to use. We didn't have any software integrated on it. It was just a basic Android display that had a UI that mimicked payments and different things like that. But then it requires so much work at the back end. There's so many, all these different valves, everything to try to make this prototype work for the customer. So that's when I come in then. So I studied product design engineering at Strathclyde, did the master's in that and graduated in 2018. And then I came on as their first hire as a product design engineer. I remember when I went to the interview, I didn't really expect to get the job at all. I was thinking, oh yeah, this looks too good to be true. This is designing a beer dispensing machine from the ground at a startup. I mean, that would be amazing to do. I'll go to the interview for the experience, but I never thought I would get it. Luckily, I did. Straight into I think the first few days, and was just getting an understanding of how they pour beer, because everyone in the company didn't come from a beer background. And I think that played a very important role coming into an area where none of us knew about how beer was poured, how did it all work, because I think that gave us a chance to really shake up the market and change things, because beer technology hasn't really changed in 20, 30 years. I think about maybe 2 or 3 years before Ebar started, there were flow meters and maybe some temperature displays, and that was like, whoa, that's amazing. That's, you know, you can see the temperature of the beer, whereas that is very simple stuff for, yeah, for people who know tax. So, that was a kind of thrown into the deep end, really, learning all about beer and learning about how the machines operated, pneumatics, electronics, and it took a few years of development and refining the product to be what it is today. Then we started with that alpha unit, then built 3 more units that we got some a lot more trials out to loads of different venues. And then from there, we started to grow the team. My title changed to lead engineer. I have a great team at the moment. Still a small engineering team, but we're a very good focused team, I would say. And yet now we have 50 mobile units and loads of inbuilt permanent solutions and stadiums and venues all around the UK.
So going back to, you've been at uni, you go to the Ebar interview. At the time, there's 2 founders.
Yep.
Very early stage. So I guess there's a couple of questions. What do you think they saw in you there for them to take the big jump to bring you into a company? It's all about product innovation.
It's a good question, because especially looking at other opportunities in the market as well, especially in product design, there's so many jobs that say you need 10 or more years experience, which I think especially in product design roles, I don't necessarily agree with, because I would say you could have one person that's got, say, 10 years experience in, a mechanical field about drivetrains or something, and then they go into a product design company, but they need to know loads of other different mechanisms and loads of other different areas. So I would personally normally disagree that someone that has 10 years experience is better than someone that has 1 year experience doing a whole range of things. But I think it's a good question. What do they see in me? I love building machines. I think it was my first year of uni, or maybe it was actually a bit before, just when 3D printers were coming to market, because the patent ran out a few years before that, so it's become much more open sourced. So I was looking at, I always wanted to build my own. I couldn't afford them at that stage because they were still really expensive. They were still up around £1,000, and you know, I wouldn't have that much money when I was younger, still saving pocket money and stuff. But I was reading into it. I thought it was quite interesting. And I remember saying to my older brother, I was saying, I want to build one. I bet I could build one. And he was like, nah, no chance. There's no way you can do it. And I was like, okay, let's put a bet on it. we'll bet €50. If I build a 3D printer that can print a small toy Porsche, then yeah, he'll give me the €50. And that was enough incentive to me to go and build this 3D printer. So and I think that's when I learned just a lot about my interest in building machines had started out, learning about coding just from a basic Arduino that programmed a machine to just all the wee features. It took a long time for me to build this because I was just trying to build it as cheap as possible so I'd make profit from this €50 that I get from my brother. It ended up costing a lot more in the end, but...
But did you get the €50?
I got it in the end. Yeah,
there you go.
It worked well. It was nice. It was built from... We were refurbishing the bathroom, so it was built from the skirting boards for the whole frame. It was actually all made out of wood initially because I needed all these parts I carved out. It took a long time to like hand carve all these like machine components. Got the printer working, and then I started reprinting the components that I hand carved to make it more and more accurate. So it'd keep on, you know, every time it prints out one part and I replace it, it would be able to reproduce that part more accurately. So I started building up from that. But yeah, I think that's where my love for building machines and kind of more knowledge of electromechanical stuff and kind of my interest in that started growing. So I suspect it was I guess my enthusiasm for building machines and having a hands-on approach that helped.
I mean, the guys at Ebar must have been like, well, if he's done this from skirting boards, I can build these pint pouring machines, surely, right? That's exciting.
Must be like, are you Tony Stark? Is this your hero origin story? You know, in a cave building your first suit?
I think so, yeah.
So, and I guess, so you go to the interview, sounds like a really amazing chance to get hands-on experience doing it. But joining an early stage business that early on, you know, with probably no revenue coming in, no established product, what was the kind of biggest challenges for you joining that kind of company?
I think personally it was probably the biggest challenge was just really moving. It was based up in Aberdeen at that stage, so it was really just kind of, you know, because I've moved over from Ireland to go to Strathclyde and Glasgow for university, and then it was really moving up. Do I want to go further away from friends and everything? But I think I was just, in terms of like company risk and everything, I was just really excited for the job. That didn't really come to mind. I was like, you know, we'll make it work. It'll be good. I was just really keen to get involved. It just seemed like such a great opportunity. So I didn't really worry about any kind of company risk or anything at that time. It was it was just good fun, really. And at that stage, my end of year university project was actually building a desktop injection molding machine. It's another like rapid prototype machine. So I think that probably also helped me get in as well. It's like, oh,
here's... So you were ripping the curtains off in the student flat to build that, or?
we don't tell anyone about that one yet.
Nice. Yeah.
Was there any points, especially early on, that you there were just challenges you didn't think you could overcome? Like I know when I joined businesses and stuff like that, you get to, I guess personally, you might feel a bit of like an imposter kind of syndrome, be like, well, I don't know how to fix this, but then it's kind of building that problem-solving muscle, you know, I guess.
100%, yeah, definitely. It happened a lot, especially thrown into such a deep end that, like, okay, I'm the only engineer here, and, you know, the two co-founders, both great mentors, but they're not engineers. So it's like, well, where do I go for advice? So there's definitely that imposter syndrome that kicks in. And especially when it's, you know, it's not just a small product you're making. It's not just, okay, I need to make this sun visor or something, something kind of like this, kind of one bit of molded plastic or whatever it is. There are so many different parts to this machine, and there's so many different areas to design. This is something that you think, should there not be massive teams designing each one of these tiny little pieces? That was definitely kind of like a scary but exciting challenge to overcome, really. I think like the systems in the Ebar at that time, it was a lot of pneumatics, which I have never known anything about before. It was beer systems, which are all pressurized gas and liquid systems. The whole electronic side, bit of programming side as well. So it was all, I guess, scary kind of going into that, but fun to overcome. I think the only, apart from, you know, kind of knowing machines and kind of knowing quite a lot of different mechanisms, mechanical assemblies, and kind of rough knowledge of, say, Arduino coding, Raspberry Pi coding, and things like that. The only other experience I had was I done an internship before at a company called McTaggart Scott that mainly deal in hydraulics. So I kind of had a small bit of hydraulic knowledge that kind of I could understand pneumatics quite quickly because of that, relatively similar. A lot of kind of hoops to overcome at the start.
Did you have any kind of support outside the company that kind of helped you through some of these kind of phases?
From a kind of technical perspective, not too much. There were, especially with a company that small, it's one of the biggest challenges we had was, was suppliers. Some suppliers would be very helpful and that could help you in some of these areas. But the problem with that is that they want to sell their product. You know, it may not be the best product or part that you need where another manufacturer would. So you kind of have to take what they say sometimes with a pinch of salt. But that would have been a big challenge that, you know, some of the bigger companies that could definitely help with that and were very engaged with now. would be more difficult to get information for them because, like, oh, that's just a small company. We don't want to, you know, deal with you or anything. It's just that's just one person asking questions about pneumatics. This isn't something that's worth our time. Whereas now it's kind of the other way around, which is a big difference. But yeah, that was definitely a hurdle for like a technical perspective to overcome. Yeah.
And then segueing back to the product itself, explain to anybody watching this, what does an e-bar look like?
Yeah, that's a good question to start. So an e-bar is pretty much, it's a self-service beverage machine. So at the moment, we're mainly focused on beers and stouts and ciders and different carbonated products. But essentially, a customer would walk up to the machine. They would select how many drinks they want, pay by card, and then they have their pints in and out within 30 seconds, payment included at the moment. We're going to speed that up. But the whole aim of it is to reduce queues and eliminate queues. Our tagline is so you can get changing the world the way the world is served, and so you can get back to the event that you want came to see. You don't want to be waiting. I know British people normally like to spend time in queues, but not at events. They want to get back to seeing the gig or seeing the game. So we are all about speed of service. We want to get people in and out as quickly as possible. But also, it's an enjoyable experience for them as well. Mm-hmm. So you know, it's very cool watching the pints fill up and then the head forming at the end. So going a bit back to the tech and how we do that, I spoke a wee bit before, is that we pressurize the glass before we pour it, and that starts any CO2 breaking out. And that is essentially how we can pour very fast. And we're constantly putting some more time into R&D and different projects to speed that up even further. But along with that, we also found that by pouring under pressure, you don't have, you barely have any waste at all. You have the tiny bit that you pull through in the keg at the start of the game, and then any keg change or anything, you should have no waste because you're not losing any beer. You don't have any foam that you would get from a normal tap, because as soon as you open a normal beer tap, CO2 starts breaking out and you have the foam building up then. And beer foam creates more beer foam. it's an endless cycle. So yeah, we found that it reduced waste, it's a lot quicker, but also it tastes a lot better. It tastes the way the brewer intended it for it to taste like. It is straight from the keg, it's fresh, it hasn't been sitting the lines long. And it's very cold when you want it to be cold as well.
Nice, good. Nice. And you mentioned the other drinks as well. Am I right in saying that espresso martinis, which is my favourite cocktail, can also be poured from an e-bar?
Yep, that's correct. Wow. It's also my favourite drink. That and Guinness. So we do different types of. So that's a nitro-infused cocktail that we do. The espresso martini and the passion fruit martinis.
Wow.
But essentially, you can pour anything through it. Anything that is in a keg, you can pour through an e-bar. But we are focused at the moment primarily on carbonated beverages because that is where our skill sets lie. That's where we're different to any other competitors, that we are very good at carbonated beverages.
You mentioned Guinness. There's a lot of debate or controversy around how a Guinness is poured and how well it can be poured, mm-hmm. and indeed how it tastes. How was that going? Was that tough? Was that a challenge?
That was a project I was really, really looking forward to a long time, and then when I was actually doing the project, that was very exciting. But a part of me was like, this is going to upset a lot of people back home. this is a risky project. But we have had some of the technical dispense team from Diageo come down and taste it, and they were very impressed. And I was like, "Wow, this is really good." Personally, I think before they came down, my thought was like, "I think they're coming down just so they can really maybe say no. We don't want it to pour that fast." But they came down, they tasted it, they loved it. It was perfect. It was a lot. The Guinness that we pour is better than most bars that I've been to. And I'm not just saying that because I work for eBar, but it is a very, very good pint of Guinness.
And how many pints of Guinness did you need to drink to get to that point? Was there quite a few?
It was a couple of kegs, yeah, yeah. I think we perfected it after two kegs, but I did the four kegs. But yeah.
In terms of the business and its growth, what are the kind of milestones that you've achieved? You kind of won those milestones, and what are you trying to get to next?
Yeah, so I think initially it was just really getting the name out there as being a reliable product, because there's a lot of beer tech out there that looks great and works for the first couple of pints, but as soon as you get a long queue and as soon as demand increases, though, its beer starts to foam up and everything starts to kind of like go downhill from there, and you have to slow everything down. Whereas us, we can manage that. We can keep on going. So that was the main kind of like point, is getting the reliability, the word of reliability out there for Ebar, which is I would say we've established that quite well at this point. But it is quite difficult to get into new venues and stadiums, partially because there's a lot of different teams that are involved in these decisions. In the UK as well, in a lot of bars and restaurants and pubs and clubs, it's the brewery that provides all equipment. So from the venue's point of view, they're like, well, we're getting all the equipment for free. Why do we need to, you know, to pay for another machine? But I think once they see that, see the improvements and benefits to them and the incremental revenue that they get on top of what their bars are already selling, they see the benefits from it. But yeah, the next stage of growth is that we are using these mobile units primarily to showcase what the e-bars can do. So we go to venue to demonstrate, place these beer walls in different locations mobile units in different locations to find the best fit, and then hopefully the venue get a permanent solution. They buy the units and install them, and then they operate themselves as well.
So we're talking about milestones in the business. Let me try and kind of frame it to like my knowledge of what you do, which is kind of limited. I've not really built hardware before or anything like that, but I follow Tesla and stuff, and I kind of follow that kind of world. So I guess building the prototype that works and works well, and then you need to build the factories, machines, supply chain to build more of those at scale, and then you need to try and distribute those and somehow balance the kind of cash flows and stuff like that, right? So
yes,
sounds a nightmare.
there is a lot in it. I think the difficulty that we have from a technical perspective is actually getting the design freeze for the product. You know, if we said, okay, here is the e-bar that has these features, and that's going to be it, let's, you know, do a design freeze there, it would be much easier to scale up, because you could say, okay, we're never going to change these connectors, these components, let's build a permanent PCB in the unit, let's you know, get hundreds of these components in stock, because, you know, you get the better discounts when you buy in bigger volume. But for us, we want to keep on top of that that R&D curve. We want to keep being leaders. We don't want to just say here it is, here's the e-bar, and then not continuously improve. We want to be continuously developing. So that definitely has been a challenge as well in that point of view, because all the components and everything we select them so we can upgrade them, so we can change them, we can change the sensors, add better sensors, improve different monitoring capabilities of the units, and so on. Yeah, sorry, did that answer your question?
Yeah, so I guess that's the one of the complexities just now. And I think versioning from a software world is easier, like over-the-air updates and, you know, that sort of thing. But from a hardware point of view, it must be really difficult. A bit like the, you know, iPhone 5, 6, 7, 8. Do you just have like a cutoff where you say, right, this is going to be E-bar 5, and we're going to draw a line under it here, and then move on R&D and let the rest of the team push out the kind of older E-bar?
To an extent. Yes, but there are some major upgrades that we have developed in the kind of thought about and kind of roughly designed into the very initial units that we can still upgrade. And one example is that is an automatic cup feed unit. So at the moment, until a couple of weeks ago, customers will have to take their cup from a cup hopper or from a shelf and place it manually, which is just more interaction that we want to avoid, because when you do that, you could have people, it just really slows down the process a bit. Mm. So the automatic cup feed solution would just drop a cup in the chamber, just all ready there for when the customer comes up. So we've always known that that's going to be an important development. So we've designed that in a couple of iterations back that we're still able to upgrade. There are certain things, if there are like a big change needed to the actual physical form of the unit, we're like, okay, well, it's going to have to be a different version than that. But yeah, hardware management of versions is can be quite tricky, because at the same time we want everything to be as streamlined as possible at the back of house, and being able to operate the units, and even for us to, you know, if a venue are having problems and they call the engineer support number, we want that to be the kind of same fixes all the time. We don't want to say, oh, what version do you have? Or, oh, what does this look like? What setup do you have? So it's trying to keep everything as standard as possible is definitely challenging.
And I guess that's the challenges of scaling business, you know, where you're getting beyond kind of how good you are. And I guess, have you got a team that you've kind of hired in and built around you, or how does that kind of work?
Yeah, so at the moment, we're still a very small team that look after the engineering side of it. So it's myself as lead engineer, and then we have our maintenance engineer, Craig Simpson, who looks after all the units down south. It's one person that takes on a lot of work. He goes around just doing maintenance here and there on the fixed units, and then when the mobile units come back to base, he can give them the annual service and things like that. And then we also have Alex Duff, who's instrumental in doing the beer wall assembly, managing all that with our assembly partners, and design and new R&D developments of that as well. So we are a very small team, but we're quite focused on, quite blessed to have the team that we have, I would say. We're there, very, very trustworthy. We get a lot done anyway.
Yeah. Small team, fully focused. Very little communication issues at that level as well, right?
You can make tons of progress. Yeah. Which is definitely going to be something that, you know, to scale and to go international and expand more than where we are going to have to grow that team substantially. And I imagine we will have a lot of scaling challenges with that. But all to look forward to.
You mentioned earlier the UK market, and just then mentioned international growth. What does that look like? How complex does that become? Launching internationally is challenging in itself, but when you're dispensing pints from a machine in a different country, how does that look from a growth perspective?
Yeah, there's a lot of things to look at, and I think that's where we're going to need to expand our team, but also delegate a lot of tasks externally as well. So it's not just like, okay, yes, we're going to go to this country, let's just send units there, because these units you can't just package them up in a box and send them off. They are 100 kilograms each. Wow. And they need to be mounted to frames. They need to be all plumbed in. You have different beers and different levels of expectation of what the head should be in different countries as well.
That's interesting, when you say that about the expectancy elsewhere. It's not just we've refined this here, we know what good looks like, because that could be completely different elsewhere.
Exactly that, yeah. And there'll be some places that are more into the customer experience rather than just getting a pint really quickly and getting out of there. So, I mean, I think we're quite lucky with our tech. With the counter pressure, we can adjust the rate of how much pressure is in the cup, how quick it's released, how it's released, and that changes how much head's formed in a pint. So if we're seeing that, okay, yes, the pint's getting a bit too heady, we can just change some settings. And it will correct that very quickly. At the moment, that's manual, but I hope to get that automatic. And then with some machine learning and stuff behind that, we can get it to auto adjust for the head quality. And that would definitely help once we're in other countries as well. Especially at I hope at that stage it's not just me managing all these different pints everywhere around the world. We'll have a bigger team by then anyway.
And have you had interest from elsewhere in the world thus far? Obviously, you're doing really well in the UK as it stands. What international markets are you looking at? And who's indeed looking at you?
Yeah, I mean, we've quite a lot of interest from some places, some clubs in Italy, in Australia as well. But yeah, there's been actually quite a lot of places in Europe also have reached out. It's just really that scalability piece and making sure that we have everything solidified and ready to go. You know, we don't want to. There's definitely a rush to get to the market as quickly as possible, but also we want to perfect the model that we have. We want to make sure that what we have here is 100% working right before we go and sell it elsewhere. You know, we don't want to be sending out, say, a machine with a new feature update that could cause loads of issues when it's away in Australia and we don't have someone to properly manage that. We want to get everything focused, which we're at that stage now, and we just need to really get the scale of the company more, which is an exciting point. I think we're at a kind of inflection point at the moment where it's going to lift off once we go international.
Yeah, it's a really pivotal point, a really exciting point, as you said. Who else does this? What does the competition look like? I imagine as you guys get bigger and more successful and attract more customers, there must be other people trying to take a kick at this, right?
100%, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's been some companies in America and even around Europe that have had kind of self-pouring machines before. I think we were one of the first, definitely in the UK anyway, to have everything front customer-facing. So the payment device, touchscreen, and everything front, so that it's fully self-service device. But there's a plethora of companies at the moment that are doing similar things. But yeah, the difference between all these other companies and us is that they don't have the pressure pour tech behind it.
Okay.
They're all still pouring open tap, and they can cool the beverage a lot beforehand, which helps with that, which helps with the delivery and the service times, but that can only last a certain period of time before that's going to start foaming. So the way that we differ is we are the only ones at the moment. I'm sure we won't be for long, but at the moment we're the only company that does this pressure pour tech for self-service as well as behind the bar.
Wow. How many, in terms of growth and scale, how many pints have you poured? Not you personally, the business. What are you guys sitting at?
Ooh, I don't know the exact number, but we're very close to a million.
Wow.
At this point.
Wow,
that's
a lot of beer.
Which is very exciting. Yeah, I think we should definitely have a party when we reach a million.
Yeah, surely. Nice.
And in terms of the future, what's the vision for, I guess, two things, eBar and for you yourself?
Yeah, I think for eBar we have a world domination, simply put. Yeah, we want eBars all around the world. We want that to be the way that you pour carbonated beverages. I think that is the main aim for it. Personally, I find it hard to visualize what it'd be like in 5-10 years. I think being part of a startup with the company changing so rapidly, you know, we kind of like changed focus quite a lot throughout the years, just as startups do. So I find it personally difficult to see where will we be in 10 years time, and what will I be doing in 10 years time.
Yeah, maybe leading the R&D division, tinkering machines, building new stuff, right?
Definitely.
That sounds like a great fit.
Because I think there's always room for improvement and development on these things. We have a lot of cool projects in the pipeline at the moment as well, and I think there's so many other new things I'm thinking, oh, this would be so cool to do in the future, but let's put it on ice for the moment until we get these kind of next focus points done. But there is always some really cool beer tech stuff we can be looking at.
Yeah, nice. I think I come from a background as a software engineer, so different from mechanical engineering, that sort of thing, but you mentioned earlier about waiting until the product's perfect and then going into other markets. But I think that's one of the challenges of being an engineer, right? Because you've got good enough from a business point of view versus perfect from an engineering point of view. How do you kind of balance that in your head?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's something that I would personally struggle with a lot as well. I would say that I find it very difficult to, say, leave something if it's not exactly perfect. Like, say, example I use is just an engineering drawings. You know, you can get, you need to get all the right information there for a company to manufacture exactly what it is and for them to look at it and understand it without any doubt. But the very last bit of it, the last 2% of the work, takes me the longest time of kind of like getting all the dimensions level, getting everything like laid out perfect. It's the last, the 98% of the work is getting everything there, and the last 2%, which takes for me the most time, which is probably the least valuable. So it's definitely something that I struggle with, that I need to, I constantly have to keep on reminding myself, okay, like, right, it's 98% done, all the important information there, just send it out and move on to the next thing.
Yeah. And how do you balance it? Do you get pressure from the business? You know, we've got milestones to achieve, and then, but you're leading technology for your part of the business, so it's, is there like a, ever a tension there, or how does that work?
What do you mean, sorry, between...
Between kind of the business goals versus like the technical goals, you know, is there like a tension there, and you kind of have to manage that, and, you know, in a constructive way, obviously, but, you know, it's like maybe like a necessary tension, because if you spend too long on technology, you run out of revenue and clients, but if you spend not enough time on technology, you get unreliable equipment and, you know, ultimately lose commercial deals.
Yeah, definitely. It's always a struggle, especially because we are such a small company. A lot of my... time is spent with kind of operation developments, kind of like maintenance, and just making sure they have everything there they need as well. And if I focus too much on kind of new R&D stuff, then that can fall down, and, you know, we might not get an event as well as we would like to. So yeah, it is definitely very difficult splitting focus. And as all startups are, priorities change quite frequently. So, you know, it's quite difficult to start a project knowing that, yes, we're going to have the next 2 weeks focused on that project and get it done from start to finish. That is very, very rarely the case. And we could start it and then realize that, oh, we have this really important opportunity at this this new venue at the weekend. We need all hands on deck to make this happen. And that pauses the project a bit more, and then someone could be sick or something, and we need to fill in for another role. So yeah, definitely challenges in prioritizing things in that respect. Yeah,
I guess that'll trickle through to who you hire, who you don't hire, culture going forward, right? Like, I've seen people that just can't adapt to that. They might be great engineers, but they need to do the start and then the finish and then move on to something. But, you know, in businesses like ours that are growing quickly, it's hardly ever like that. You just have to be comfortable with
exactly
the change, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think at the moment we are starting to hire more people for more focused roles, which will definitely help that. Now that we're expanding and wanting to go international and getting more and more venues, we need to establish these priorities and get people in that can focus on this. But yeah, up to now, it is very. Everyone needs to be flexible in the company. Everyone does a bit of everyone's job. We all help out, which is good. It's a great dynamic to have.
Yeah, nice. In terms of venues, where would somebody go to get a pint from an e-bar? What kind of venues are you in at the minute, and what venues have you got coming up to go and install to? Is there anything you can tell us on that?
Yeah, so we a lot of stuff that we're doing at the moment is Premiership football clubs and football clubs in general. Initially we thought it would be more of like the kind of horse racing cricket, where they sell a lot of pints throughout the day, which it is. But at the moment we're getting a lot of interest in Premiership football clubs because of that half-time rush. They have the 15 minutes to serve as much beer as they can. If the queues are shorter, more people join, more people buy beer. So a lot of clubs are kind of realizing that now, and realizing that, okay, if we put e-bars in, we can serve so much more beer a lot quicker, and customers are happy, staff are happy, venues happy, everyone benefits from it. So it's all incremental sales from them. We're in quite a lot of Premiership clubs at the moment. The mobile units are always active. We rarely see them, which can be challenging from a maintenance point of view sometimes. But it's good that they're always out, always being used. Normally we just go to maintain them on site now. In terms of, they're moving about all the time, but in terms of fixed beer wall units that we have installed, We've done the very first installs at Millwall Football Club and Brighton Football Club. And we also have some units in the AO Arena and Manchester City Football Club as well.
Thanks.
Which is a very exciting one.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's football clubs. Do you ever envision this being in pubs? So I guess one of the things in follow-up question would be, some people will like that interaction with a human being, right? I'll have two pints of this and have that chat. Do you envision Ebar ever taking that over? And people going into a pub and pressing a button for a pint?
I don't think it will take over pubs completely. Personally, I think it'd be a good addition for the busier service pubs. Yeah, but I think for events, I would say that the e-bars actually increase customer and staff interaction, because you will always have a staff member there in front of the e-bars. If they're behind the desk serving pints, they'll be back and forth, not engaging, just asking, what do you want? Okay, I'll go get it. Whereas the staff that we have on eBars, we actually see a better client interaction, because it's the customers getting their pints and they have time to talk to their staff, and the staff can say, oh, have you, did you see that last goal and things. It's actually a lot more engaging. But I would say I would definitely like to see eBars in the pubs in the future, but maybe that'll take a different form of what we have now. Maybe that would be instead of the taps that the bartender has, it'll be an e-bar tap. So it's still the bartender there using it, but they have that customer engagement piece.
Got it. Yeah, makes sense.
Is there anything that's going to stop you? What's the barrier? What's holding you back? It sounds like you're in some massive clubs already. You've got innovative tech from a tiny company that you've come from being so small to be able to deliver those into such large kind of clubs, you mentioned. What's the thing that could stop you, and what are you worried about?
Ooh, I think we're always limited from a hardware side. There's always challenges with supply and then upfront cost in actually getting these units ready to go out. Apart from that, it's just I think getting the trust there for venues to replace their bars with e-bars. For a lot of clubs who do, it's kind of we're replacing old betting kiosks and kind of some small space that they're not currently using. But once the clubs realise the reliability and that the additional sales and quality that they can get from the pints, it's starting to replace their bars, which is where we'll see a big increase.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Kyle. That was brilliant.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks.